Skip Schwartz joins me this week to talk about barrel-aged stouts. This is Beersmith Podcast number 287.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 287, and it's late August 2023. Skip Schwartz joins me this week to talk about barrel-aged stouts. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also the American Homebrewers Association. The Homebrewers Association invites you to choose your own brew venture. Join for 1 year and select a free brewing book for more than 60 titles. Visit homebrewersassociation.org/beersmith to join the American Homebrewers Association and treat yourself to a new brewing book. Again, that special link is homebrewersassociation.org/beersmith. And the Beersmith Web, the online version of Beersmith Brewing Software. Beersmith for the Web lets you create great beer recipes from any browser, including your tablet or phone. Edit recipes on the go with access to the same full suite of recipe building tools as our desktop version. Try Beersmith Web today by creating a free account at beersmithrecipes.com. And finally, a reminder to click that like and subscribe button on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever platform you're listening on. Clicking those buttons is a great way to support the show. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome Skip Schwartz from Weldworks Brewing. Skip is the head brewer at Weldworks, and today he joins us to talk about their barrel age beer program. Skip, it's great to have you on the show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk to you about some barrel aged stouts.
Yeah, I've had Neil. Neil and I are friends from way back, and of course, Neil's been involved in Weldworks, I think, as one of the founders. But I wanted to find out a little bit about you. How did you get involved in brewing, and how did you end up as the head brewer at Weldworks now?
Originally out of college, I did an internship distilling, and I thought I wanted to go down that route and make whiskey and distill. But I quickly found out that that wasn't for me. There's not enough. The turnaround times are too long, and it wasn't as much creativity as I wanted. So I got a job working at a small brewery. And I was doing some sales stuff and kind of helping out here and there in production. And over time, I slowly took over more and more and more of production to where I became pretty much the only person doing production at that brewery. After that stint there, I was there for about 3.5 years. I went to Black Project Spontaneous and Wild Ales down in Denver, who unfortunately has closed. And I was the production manager there. For, I think it was about a year and a half, maybe a little under two years there. And then I came up to work at Weldworks. I was hired on originally as a, it's kind of a weird thing. I interviewed for a senior brewer position, and me and another fellow by the name of Derek Gold, both were hired for the lead. It was lead brewer job, but Derek was the better fit for lead brewer, so they hired me on as just, we'll figure out what he does. And so I became known as the special projects person. So I would do research and development. I'd do all sorts of different things. I'd work with the barrels, do some of those things, and then slowly I took over the barrel cellar, and then I was, my title at that point was wooden cellar innovation lead, something crazy like that. So I was working on kind of finding out the next innovation, what we were going to do, and then that kind of transitioned into me taking over as head brewer. So I do a lot of the tank scheduling, and Derek, who like I said, started at the exact same time as me, who got the job over me for lead brewer, is now our senior director of brewing operations. So together, him and I kind of come up together at Weldworks. We're almost at our 5-year mark. We started a week apart, and we've worked very closely together for the last 5 years. So that's kind of my journey here at Weldworks and how I got here. And I guess Neil trusted me to take over as head brewer, and those are quite the shoes to fill.
That's awesome. Well, congratulations to you.
Yeah, thank you.
Were you ever into home brewing, or did you start out with any formal education, I guess, or?
Not brewing formal education. Yeah, yeah. I did go to college, but I did quite a bit of home brewing. One of my things that I wanted to do was when I was home brewing is I really wanted to be a professional brewer, and I would brew 1-gallon batches of beer, and I'd brew the exact same IPA recipe almost every day.
My goodness.
And did 1 gallon at a time, and I would do it. It's about 6 days a week. And then on the 7th day, I would usually brew a 5-gallon batch of something different.
Wow.
And it was just, I wanted to learn consistency. And that was the biggest thing that when I was reading everything I was reading and learning, self-taught, educated, was consistency is the biggest thing to being a production brewer. And so that was my biggest focus as a home brewer was being able to brew, have a 6-pack of beer all from a different batch and you not be able to tell that they were not brewed the same day.
That's a good piece of advice. Cause when I started brewing all these, every time I brewed, I'd brew a different kind of beer.
Right.
And I finally figured out it wasn't really learning much by doing that,
right.
You know?
Yep, exactly. You learn a lot more by brewing the exact same thing time in and time out. And then I end up working in a pretty big production facility that makes Juicy Bits, 3 or 4 times a week. So it's very good to have that background and that set of skills to be able to go, this little thing's off, let's tweak this. It definitely teaches you how to tweak recipes and such.
Yeah, the other thing I found out is my beer never got any better.
Well, again, consistency comes from learning those little things that you could tweak. And I think I'm sure you make great beer.
Well, this was many years ago, but yeah. So I want to ask you before you jump into stouts, talk about some of the innovation going as Weldworks. I know one of your titles was innovation manager at one time.
Yeah. So one thing that we always try to be innovative with and stay current with is hops. As a brewery that is, we do make a lot of barrel aged stouts, and we will talk about that, like you said. But one of the things that we've always kind of hung our hat on is our IPAs as well. So one of the things that we do innovation wise is we're part of a lot of like breeding programs, and we get to work with some of the so we're actually a lot of them are in New Zealand, but we're part of the Brecht Brewing Program, which is a program put on by the NZ Hops, and we're part of their program. So we get to test out some of their early hops, and we have to write a bunch of their, descriptions, help them with the descriptions, help them use it in commercial testing. That's been a program that we've been a part of for 2 years now since I started. Really enjoy that. We recently were added into Freestyle Hops, their hop connection program. And that's very similar. We were testing out some of the hops for them in a commercial setting, getting customer feedback, getting our own feedback. That's really just been a really good thing for us. We wish that more brewers we were able to do that with more hop companies. We've been working on that. Another thing that we get to do is work with yeast companies. So we've worked with Omega Yeast Labs for quite some time. They're our house yeast strain. We're working with their. We're going to be one of the first people to do a large commercial scale with their new DKO, which is the diacetyl knockout yeast strain.
Oh, interesting. Tell me about that. I haven't talked about diacetyl knockout. Although we did.
Yeah.
We did have Stan Hieronymus on a few episodes back talking about New Zealand hops. He had just returned from a trip there. So probably working with many of the same companies you are. But
yeah, probably.
Yeah. But tell us about the knockout hops.
Yeah. So the diacetyl knockout, yeast. Yeah. The diacetyl knockout yeast is a new thing that, they've been working on it for quite some time, and we've had some of their tests, but we're moving to it for a full commercial use, and hopefully switch over our house yeast. So what they've done is they've been able to genetically modify their yeast strains to produce the same enzymes as ALDC, which has become very common to be used with hoppy beers, especially the hazy ones that we're seeing hop creep. To already have that enzyme in the hop means that we don't have to add additional product like the ALDC. So we're pretty excited to test that out and see how it works and see how, if it continues to carry over generation after generation. And they're pretty confident with their testing that it should work. And we're really excited to see that. And
so I know is this to mainly fight hop creep then, I guess, or?
Yeah, it's to fight hop creep and just help with lower, you know, some of the British strains of yeast do produce a little bit of diacetyl.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty common to taste a small amount of diacetyl in most hazy beers, but as somebody who absolutely hates it, I would like to not have to worry about it. And if we don't have to pitch ALDC and yeast at the same time, it would be really nice to just use one product. But I know when we talk about innovations, the funner things is talking about hops or, you know, phantasm powder or some cool new fruit or something. But the innovations that are less glamorous or, stuff like that are really exciting to me is something like this DKO yeast. And I'm very excited to be working with Omega and hopefully the commercial scale is everything that we hope it is.
That's awesome. Well, great.
Yeah.
Well, today you wanted to focus on barrel-aged stouts. Why don't you tell us a little bit about first the barrel-aged stout style and how it's distinct from some of the other styles of stout people may be familiar with?
Yeah, so, I mean, usually most breweries, I mean, I can speak on, so Weldworks does barrel-aged stouts very different than probably most people. You know, the stout style is usually most people just take an imperial stout and then age it in a barrel. A different period of time. At Weldworks, we actually treat the barrel as an ingredient. So when we're the media noche that you taste in the market, which is our barrel aged stout, is not, you'll never taste a non barrel aged version of that beer because we treat the wood and the time spent in there as an ingredient. So it's a lot, we age a lot longer, but we make a different, very different beer. So we do three mashes on our stout and a very extended boil. So anywhere from 20 to 30 hour boils is what we're doing.
Wow. Why do you do the complex mash schedule and boils in there?
So the biggest reason is we want to have a very viscous product. That's like the biggest thing. Clearly the easiest way to reach these high, starting gravities would be to, just add sugar, you know, we could add simple sugar. We could add complex sugars, we got LME, DME, any of those kind of things to reach this high
gravity.
Right,
because just like us, you have limitations on what you can put in the mash tun, right?
Sure, yeah. Right. And we have limitations of how much grain we can put in. And you know, when Neil was writing this recipe and coming up with how he wanted to approach barrel-aged stouts, he did not want to add sugar in at all. We wanted it to all be 100% from grain, and that's kind of just the mindset and the mantra that we follow here. So we've just carried it on. And when I say high gravities, I'm talking like 30 to 40 Plato starting gravities. So, I mean, like we're talking monster beer.
What's the alcohol on that? It's gotta be quite high.
It really depends. So some fermentations are clearly better than others. And that's something that you're gonna have to deal with when you're looking at,
I mean, you're talking about
it
like an over 1100 starting gravity. Is that right?
Yeah. But yeah, so we're looking at like
1120 is what the rough number is. Yeah, Plato right. Gravity.
Yeah. So I'm sorry. What was the question?
Oh, I was saying you start with like an 1120 starting gravity. It's quite high, right? It's a
right. Yeah. So
probably
so
11-12% beer or something like that.
Yeah, so our ABVs are anywhere between 12 and 13. We've had some if we add in, you know, coconuts or something, say later on, they might go down to 10. Yeah. But yeah, we usually say the safe bet, they're going into barrels around 12 to 13.
Wow.
We've had some up into the 16 range. The 16 range ones usually get blended back with something a little bit lower gravity from our barrel stock, but just because 16% we think is a little too high.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you're almost at a barley wine, but...
Correct, exactly.
Yeah. So, so you really start with a giant imperial stout still, right? But you're going through a long, now you did talk about the long boil, and I guess you're using that to get the, to get to where you want in gravity, right? With a fairly lower starting mash gravity, probably.
Yeah.
But what are you doing? You mentioned a multi-step mash or something like that as well.
So we're doing three separate mashes. So we'll do on the first day, we'll mash in a turn. We'll do a standard mash rest, and then from there we'll do what we call a rinse instead of a full-on sparge. So we'll rinse for about a quarter of what our normal sparge volume would be. Okay. And that's just to make sure we're pushing all the sugars out of the mash tun, and we'll run that into the kettle. And then as soon as that's done, we'll get the grains out, and then we'll start a second mash. And then that'll get us up to our kettle, and we'll do the same thing. We might sparge a little bit longer on that one. We'll probably go closer to half the volume on the second sparge, so that way we get up to a kettle volume that we can boil overnight without it going drying too low. So we'll do that, and then we'll boil it overnight. And then the next morning we'll come in and we'll run an 100% normal mash. And those are usually, we're maxing out our mash tun each time. So that's around 1800 pounds of grain.
Wow.
Per mash.
Gee. Yeah. That's quite a process. And then you mentioned boiling for almost 20 hours. You're concentrating that wort way down to get the high gravity you want.
Right. And so what we've seen for the most part is we have shortened it. It originally was 36 hour boils. We've slowly shortened them. Clearly the stuff that you're boiling overnight is pretty much unfermentable. So that's why we do the third mash on the second day. And that's basically where most of our fermentable sugars are coming from.
Right.
And that's why we treat it like a normal one. So we have this huge concentrate of, syrup, for lack of better terms, a syrup that boiled overnight, and then we pump in the fresh runoff to make something fermentable.
Yeah, I would imagine there's some effect for boiling it that long, right?
Correct.
Caramelization and so on going on, right?
Yeah, correct.
Yeah, interesting. Correct. So what does the grain bill itself look like? What's the composition to get this big imperial stout?
Yeah, so our grain bill is it's a little bit more complex than probably it needs to be. But we base is just pale. We use a lot of different chocolate malts. So we use regular chocolate malt. We use chocolate rye. We use pale chocolate, which is my personal favorite. I recommend anytime that we do a collab stout, we always try to include pale chocolate.
And of course, the pale chocolate's on the edge of that harsh zone, so you're getting some of that complexity too, right?
Right, correct. And then we use a mix of different crystal malts, so it's usually 40, 60, and then the equivalent of 150. I think that it's the DRC from.
That's another one of those harsh malts, kind of like a special, probably close to a special B, right?
Correct. Yeah. And then we do use roasted barley, but that one we use in such a low amount that I don't even really consider us because of how harsh roasted barley can be. We use it's less than a bag between all three turns. So, and then we use a little bit of Carafa Special 2, which is also a little bit harsher.
Yeah.
But that's pretty much the what we use. Like I said, the ratios. We could get a little more specific if we wanted to, but it's mostly pretty low. But the chocolates we go pretty high on.
So so what percentage of specialty malt overall? Are you running like 10-20%?
Yeah.
Somewhere in
20,
there.
Probably 20. Closer to 15.
Yeah. Yeah. That's still quite a bit of specialty
malt. Quite a bit. Yeah. Especially when we're doing three turns.
Get the flavor going. Yeah.
I will say that, we are not the most efficient, people when it comes to barrel aged stouts. I like to say that we make irresponsible barrel aged stouts.
Yeah. What about the hops? What are you doing for hops?
Hops, we're just doing after the full boil, we'll pick whatever time we're set for. Within 60 minutes, we'll add in a little bit of just Magnum just to get a bitterness. It usually ends up being around 50 to 60 IBUs, depending on if they're actually dropped at 60.
Which isn't all that high for the gravity you're using, probably, right?
No, correct. Yeah. It is fairly low, considering that's probably true to like a normal Imperial or Russian Imperial stout. That even might be low for that style as well. So
yeah,
it's fairly low, but it's Yeah, most of the times they probably, because like I said, we're boiling for so long, it probably goes in closer to 90 minutes or even, you know, 120. So it the bitterness kind of fluctuates depending on when the hops are actually dropped by whoever is brewing.
Yeah, yeah. Are you doing anything special with the water? Are you using a special water profile?
No, we're not doing anything with the water. We might add some baking soda to the mash prior, but that's really rare. That's kind of something we do with more of our imperial stouts and milk stouts rather than our barrel aged stuff.
And then what about yeast and fermentation? How are you managing initial fermentation?
Yeah, so
you got a very high gravity starting, you know.
Correct. Yeah. So one of the hardest things is actually with such a thick and high gravity beer is getting the correct oxygen into it. So we try to run it off slow, but like I said, our oxygenation stone struggles pretty hard to get in. So it kind of, you see bubbles of O2 going through it rather than, you know, a normal, you see little streams of small bubbles.
Sure,
in ours, it's a challenge. See just giant bubbles going through. So it's pretty hard for us to hit those, the same oxygen. So we do pitch quite a bit more yeast. We're putting in a 15 barrel batch. We're putting in, I think it's 3 kilograms of yeast, which is about double what we do on a normal stout or normal, you know, USO5 is what we're using for that dry yeast. And that's just because we can't repitch it. So there's no point in using, you know, something wet or kind of keep the cost on that part.
So you're using USO5, and I don't remember off the top of my head, but is it a high gravity? Is it tolerant? Yep. Alcohol tolerant, I guess?
It is tolerant enough for what we're trying to accomplish. Like I said, we have gotten up into the 16s before, or 16% ABV.
Yeah, because a lot of beer yeast won't tolerate that much alcohol.
So. Right. And yes, for some reason, it's worked for us, the USO5. But like I said, we're already dealing with a really hard beer to ferment anyways. And when we're doing collabs, we tell people these things. They're like, well, how much attenuation are you seeing? I said anywhere from 60 to 40%, depending on what the beer is and how healthy it is. On stuff when we're up in the 40 Play-Dohs, which, we don't do those very often.
Yeah.
We do probably one batch of those a year just as a blender for extra, just for different projects. But what we're usually looking for, on those higher ABV ones, the next day, usually day two, we're actually going to add more oxygen into the bottom of the tank.
That's one of the questions I was going to ask you. It's very common, high gravity meads, high gravity wines, even some high gravity beers to add a second dose of oxygen at 12 hours or so. Are you doing that as well?
Yeah, usually somewhere between 12 and 24, sometimes maybe twice in that time frame. It's just, we do treat it more like a wine or a mead because of that. And again, I'm not really scared of, because of we're going to put it into a barrel, I'm not scared of oxygen ingress occurring at any step of the process. I'm sure we'll talk about that when we get into the actual barrel.
Yeah, but with a high gravity beer, actually the oxygen doesn't really hurt it that much. At least in the first 24 hours or so, and it can still process a lot of that and absorb a lot of that oxygen. None of it will end up in the finished beer.
Exactly. So overall, that's kind of what we're looking at. But like I said, the fermentation is about as rough as we probably would like it in our brew house. It's the only beer that we accept poor fermentation parameters. You know, if it's a little bit rocky, if it's slow, if it's that's the only one that we kind of just let it do its thing.
Do you do anything special with the yeast, like prepping it? I mean, because one of the big concerns with a gravity that high is osmotic shock, which is where you take yeast cells, especially dry yeast cells, and throw them right into a very high gravity beer, and you have problems. Do you take some time to acclimatize the yeast before you pitch?
Nope. You don't. It's kind of one of those things where
things you might want to try in the future. I don't know.
No. We have tried it. We have tried using liquid yeast and different things and harvested yeast from second generation yeast. But honestly, what we found is kind of like don't fix what isn't broken type thing. Yeah. And I know that it's not. I know it's not the best thing to say, but it's just we've tried these other things and they've kind of come to the same conclusion. And even some of the second generations have actually petered out when we've seen USO5 continue forward.
Yeah.
So as weird as it sounds, for some reason it just works.
Well, maybe that. Yeah, maybe the USO5 is more tolerant. I don't know.
USO5 is a workhorse, and I would recommend that for anybody who's just doing anything that you don't need flavor from yeast. We use that yeast quite a bit in house. So
do you let it? Do you have a particular temperature profile? Do you let it free rise? Do you just hold it to kind of a mid range temperature?
Yeah, we're usually around 68, which is optimal for USO5. And we just kind of let it do its thing there. And fermentation temp is it's pretty standard. We don't really have to worry about diacetyl too much in this. Usually we don't see too much diacetyl, but even if we did through the extended aging, that kind of goes away anyways. But we do keep it in the fermenter for 20 to 22 days.
So that's a good period of time to let it age out, right?
Yeah, correct.
And I assume you're pulling it off the yeast at that time as well.
Correct. Yeah. We're constantly dumping yeast, pretty much daily, dumping off the bottom. Sometimes we'll do a little bit heavier. I mean, right before we go into the barrel, we're clearly going to do a really heavy dump on it. But yeah, so I'm trying to get as much yeast out. We'll crash around day 20. Usually goes into barrels around day 22.
Wow, so it does go directly into the barrel then from the fermenter, huh?
Correct. Yeah.
Interesting. And you just do that with based on time, I guess, 20, 22 days roughly.
Yeah. Usually it's basically, I mean, clearly usually by day 12 to 14, you're seeing it's pretty much done fermenting. And so the rest of it is kind of clean up, make sure some of the yeast drops out. But yeah, for the most part, we make sure it's stable clearly before we're putting it into the barrel. If it's still fermenting, we can hold it out longer in the tank until it's done. But we've never, at 22 days, we've never seen, or even day 20, we've never really seen fermentation moving in a beer that sweet.
That's cool. That's awesome. Yeah. Well, I guess we ought to move on to barrels. Now, we could easily take up a whole show talking about barrels.
Yeah.
But what type of barrels are you using, just sort of at a base level, and how are you managing them over time?
Yeah, so we use 90% of our barrel warehouse is bourbon barrels, usually oak, just American Kentucky bourbon barrels.
Mm-hmm.
We get them from all over America, but mostly Kentucky. The organization of that is quite a task. So at our biggest, we had 650 oak barrels filled in our warehouse, and we sit around 350-ish now. That's kind of where we found as our sweet spot. So it's quite the task to make sure we're keeping eyes on all of them. But we have a spreadsheet that has a lot of hard data on it for each barrel, with stuff like ages, gravities, starting gravities, alcohol, calculated alcohol. I like to say calculated because we haven't ran it through our alkalizer prior to going into the barrel.
Right.
Batch numbers, all that kind of stuff. And then each barrel itself has similar data printed in a sheet hanging on front of it. So that way we can walk through and look at stuff and look at those numbers. Spreadsheet clearly with, the how long it's been in there is a little bit more accurate because it can automatically update itself to tell you it's at blah, blah, blah month instead of doing the math. But math is fun, too. Yeah. And then for kind of managing it, we do have a dedicated warehouse that does have humidity control for the wintertime. Since we live in Colorado, our winters are extremely dry. Super so it dry, does have humidity control for winter. And then it also has heating and a little bit of air conditioning. The air conditioner does go out sometimes, which is okay. I kind of adopted this philosophy from Neil when he was kind of overseeing all the barrel stuff. And it's to kind of let it go through the seasons. We want it to experience the changes of the season. Clearly, the heater in the wintertime is just so we don't freeze. It doesn't really, I wouldn't say the room can be warm, and some of the barrels will get warmer than others. But the biggest thing is we want to make sure that we are keeping them from freezing, and that's 100% it. We want to see it go through the cycle of every season, and in the winter, it's contracting and pulling the beer into the wood versus the summer, it's kind of expanding and spitting the wood out. So we want it to go through those cycles of going in and out of the wood. That's something that's really big for us. But twice a year, we are going in, two to three times, sometimes more, we're going in and we're organizing all of the barrels to make sure that they are in a certain order that we have. So that way, when we go to pick them for blending stock and to actually produce the final products, we're able to get to the ones that we need to as easy as possible and not lifting through all of the brand new filled ones first. And all the old ones are in the back.
Cool. Before we dive into that, how do you manage the barrels themselves? Are you reusing them multiple times? Are you, how do you manage the barrels from batch to batch?
Yeah. So, we are only currently using barrels one time per, single use, per barrel. So,
yeah.
Single use. So it does add a little bit of cost into, the way that we're doing. But like I said earlier, I would say we're very irresponsible with how we, produce barrel aged stout. We do use them once. If they come in and they're a little dry, we will we'll do a hoop hammer on them and hammer the hoops in place a little bit more. And then we'll do something called a bird bath, which is where you're going to put hot water, hot liquor, whatever you want to call it, on top of the barrel, on the barrel head, and that'll help swell the staves around it and kind of get it back to tight. We do not put any liquids in the barrel. Just so that way we're keeping that bourbon flavor. Since we paid for the bourbon flavor and the oak flavor, we want to see that come through in the final beer. So by rinsing it with hot liquor or hot water, whatever, like I said, however you want to call it, you're going to remove some of those flavors. And the biggest thing is to try our hardest to keep those flavors intact until they can reach the beer. So the goal would be to not do anything at all to the barrels, but sometimes they come in a little bit less than ideal shape. So we have to.
Yeah. I mean, you also can't leave them dry very, very long either, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. You got to use them pretty quick when they come in, I would think.
Yes. So. Yeah. We the longest we usually try to leave the things empty would be 3 months. And that depends on how long they've been in a warehouse prior to.
Yeah.
We work with a lot of people that get us barrels really quickly. Our brokers have been really good to us. So, we usually get them within a couple weeks of them getting them. So that gives us that 3 month window. If they've had them in their warehouse, they usually let us know how long they've been, and then we'll adjust our production schedule to fit, to make sure that we're not leaving them empty from the distillery to when we fill them for longer than 3 months. We'll make exceptions, but we try not to.
Now, on managing the barrels as you're going through aging, do you top them off as you go? How do you handle that? Because obviously they lose a little bit of volume over time.
Yeah, so we do not top off our barrels. It's partially because we don't, in Colorado, we don't lose a terrible amount. Like I said, it's dry, but the way that it works is that we're actually at an altitude to where we're actually not losing as much angel share as, say, somebody maybe in Texas or somewhere else.
Right.
So because we're not losing it, we're not, we're not super worried about keeping it. The other thing that this is a personal belief of mine, and that's kind of how we've done the barrel age program is we're not really worried about oxygen ingress at all. We move our barrels when we have to move them. We don't top them up. If we didn't want some oxygen character, oxidized character in the beer, we wouldn't put it in a barrel.
The nice thing about getting a little bit of oxygen in something like an imperial stout, it's going to add more of a sherry type finish to it instead of the paper
Correct.
Cardboard thing, right?
That's right. Kind of nice. And that's the big thing for us is that, we make a sweet product on purpose to hold up to those oxygen ingress and those flavors that come from that. And the biggest thing for us is that it's part of our belief. And I know people get really worried about their barrel-aged stouts getting too much oxygen, and it's just not something we worry about. And like I said, if I was super worried about it, I wouldn't have put it in a barrel to begin with.
Yeah.
That's not something that keeps oxygen out. So instead of fighting it and trying to, I've heard of people like, they purge the barrel before they fill it with stout, they purge with CO2. And I'm just like, I don't understand, because by the time you're done
purging it,
time you move it into the resting space, it's that all that space is oxygen again. Anyway, it's just like I said, that's one of those things that I've always kind of seen like I'm on the outside, of the overall, brewers or professional brewers, when I say that I genuinely don't fight it. I embrace it. I like oxygen being involved in our barrel-aged stouts.
Yeah. Well, how do you go about determining when the beer's done? Do you have a certain amount of time that you work with, leave it in the barrel, or do you taste it periodically? How do you manage that?
So the first thing is that we have an 18-month minimum, and that was kind of just based off of the initial tastings that Neil had done with these beers over time. And so we won't taste anything before 18 months. Mm-hmm. And then when we're going for a project, we're more looking to fill what our project demands, right? So if we're just doing a non-adjuncted barrel-aged stout, then we're trying to blend for a flavor profile that we have in our head, or blending because we want to use, like, let's say we have our W12, which was aged in all Weller 12 barrels. We're going to blend those to kind of fit what we think does a really good job of showcasing the Weller 12 flavors.
Hmm. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, yeah. So we're 18 months minimum, but we kind of blend for the project. So yeah.
So are you tasting it periodically then after the 18 months to maybe say, okay, this is kind of in the ballpark or what?
No, not really. We're like I said, we're more tasting dependent once a project has been put on the plate, and we look through the spreadsheets and kind of feel out what we're looking for. And before we walk into a room full of 350 barrels, let's say if we have 350, there's probably half of them are above that age.
Yeah.
So I don't need to go through and taste, 150 plus beers,
yeah,
to 175 beers, or barrels, to do that. So we have to kind of narrow it down based on, our knowledge of what those beers taste like. I mean, at this point we've been doing it for 7 years. So yeah, we know kind of, what a gravity plus a pH plus that barrel, what that will do over time. So we have a starting point. We kind of look at that starting point. We pick out barrels based on that, and then we'll go to that stack and we'll taste through probably that stack of barrels and then go, okay, these two are really good. Let's mark them. And then that's it for the day. And then we go do it again. But again, when we're talking about blending huge amounts of barrels, it makes it really hard to just go in and taste a ton of barrels.
Yeah.
I'd say after three or four, maybe if you're lucky, you get five really good tastes in before you blow out your palate and you can't taste as accurately as you were at the beginning.
Yeah, especially at that alcohol level, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So you mentioned blending a number of times. I assume you're doing, you are blending the beers in some way. Is there any kind of rule of thumb you use for determining what to blend? Do you blend good with bad? Do you only blend good with good? How do you work on that?
Sometimes you want to blend in. I mean, so the thing with bad is, bad is so subjective. As long as you're not talking about all flavors, right?
Yeah.
So just because I like something might be more roasty, and like to me, a heavier roasted imperial stout might not be as good as say like a smoother chocolatier one. But that doesn't mean that together they make something really great. So yeah, it's just, again, it mostly depends on what the project is. If we're gonna add coconut to a beer, I'm looking for stuff that has really big coconut from the wood flavors or from the spirits, which does happen quite a bit. Vanilla is another flavor profile that you're going to see a lot in our barrels, so we're just kind of looking for that. But yeah, if we get lucky and all of them are deemed really like grade A, class one, best of the best, and we can make a blend with that, of course I'm going to do that.
Yeah,
but like I said, each one is going to have its own little maybe what I call flaw, but it's not necessarily a flaw, it's just like, oh, this stands out a little differently than this. But if we do find a barrel that's like, hey, this barrel right here is something special, we'll take that barrel and release a single barrel. Usually it's draft only, and we'll release something special with that really cool, unique flavor profile, or just this is grade A example of what we want.
So can you combine certain flavors maybe to make a better beer in the end?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we do that all the time. And that's usually the goal of our blending, is to take a bunch of different elements and put them together and make something nuanced and complex that otherwise might be more like, oh, this is just chocolate, or this one's just roast, or this one's a ton of bourbon, and this one's a ton of oak. But if you add them all together, you can get all those flavors. And I think the sums usually are better than, just the parts.
So you mentioned you had 350 or so barrels in the program. Are they all barrel-aged stout, or are you using them for other things like sours and so on?
We currently have no mixed fermentation. We do have a couple of kettle sour, quick sours in barrels, but not much.
Yeah.
And barley wine, we have probably less than 10.
Oh, wow.
So
it really is focused on the stouts, I guess.
Correct.
It is really cool.
Mostly focused on stouts. Our barrel program pretty much revolves around the barrel-aged stouts. We were lucky enough to win within our second year. We won a GABF gold medal for barrel-aged stout.
Oh, and then that
same beer went on to win a Festival of Barrel-Aged Beers gold as well. Or, excuse me, a silver on that one. So we've been lucky enough to win some awards for it, and that kind of pushed us into, well, let's just run with this.
That's awesome. Well, good.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, what are some of your tips? Let's take it down to the homebrew scale now for a minute.
Sure.
What are some of the tips you might have for a homebrewer looking to make a great barrel-aged stout?
So the biggest thing would be working on sourcing barrels. I know that trying to fill a 53-gallon barrel seems intimidating, but there are some great ways to do that. There are also great ways of doing smaller ones that fit the size system. I would recommend searching for local distilleries. Some of the smaller distilleries are using smaller barrels, and they'll part with those. And if you end up getting a big barrel and you're in a homebrew club, sometimes it's really fun to get everyone to brew a 5-gallon batch or 10-gallon, whatever their size system they're working with, whatever kit they're on, and then kind of blending them all together and putting them in the barrel. And instead of emptying all 53 gallons, kind of make it into a Solera project. And whenever you empty out, you fill back up with a new brew, and that kind of becomes more easy to keep going. Of course, over time, you will lose some of that wood flavor or some of that, spirit flavor. But I do think that working in a group of people is always fun. Having different systems and maybe even different recipes adds complexity into it. There are plenty of websites that you can buy small barrels on. Some of them don't have spirits. So another thing I'd recommend if you want the spirit flavor is, since you are homebrewing and you're not selling this, you can add your own spirit into it. So you could take a spirit that you personally enjoy, have it age in that barrel for quite some time. Once you take it, then you take the bourbon back out or spirit back out and enjoy a deeper barrel-aged expression of one of your favorite spirits. That's something that I enjoy doing as a homebrewer. And then, of course, if you cannot get any barrels, there's always oak spirals or chips that you can play around with to get some oak flavor and that sort of thing. But that would be my tips, is worried about mostly of sourcing your barrels and making sure that you're able to fill them to start all the way to the top before you let them rest. Again, you're going to lose some, and that is okay, but I think it's very important to start all the way at the top, because you don't want to come out and empty your barrel and it's only a quarter of the way full.
Hmm. And I mean, do you recommend starting with a high gravity imperial stout? Is that really does that seem like the best base to start with?
If you're going to try to reuse the barrel, then probably not. I think that if you do a high gravity imperial stout, you're going to I think you ruin the barrels. That's why we don't clean them and use them again. But if
why is that? I was just wondering how does it ruin the barrels? I was kind of interested in finding out.
That dark flavor kind of, well, first off, we're aging ours so long that there's not much spirit flavor left. And that's a big part of what we're going for.
Makes sense.
In our expressions. So to reuse it, we're going to get a lot of the oak, which is great. And I like oak, but we definitely want the spirit to be very prominent in our final product. So that's part of the reason. And then the second reason is, if we were to do a second beer, like let's say like something lighter, a lot of that, like I said, when we're expanding and contracting into the woods, a lot of that gets stuck in there, and then it will kind of taint the other beers and make them a little bit darker than we probably wanted them. So
makes sense.
And like I said, with us not doing very many barley wines or mixed firm or even, quick sour barrel aged stuff, there's really no need for us to reuse them without that spirit flavor. So
interesting.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Skip. I wanted to get, we are coming to the end of our time, but I wanted to get your closing thoughts on barrel aged stouts, and indeed, anything you have to say maybe as head brewer as well.
For me, for barrel-aged stouts and people who want to try it at home, I think the biggest thing is it seems intimidating, and I would like to say it's really not, and it's really fun. As somebody who started in a distilling background, I think mixing those two worlds is really fun, and I think it's something that, if it seems intimidating, it's not. Just remember, you're making beer. It's supposed to be fun. It's if it turns out terrible, you know what? Try again. I just can't imagine if you do all the things that you know how to do as a home brewer and get it into a barrel that's a good quality barrel, you're going to have a good product at the end. And don't get discouraged if you don't on your first try.
Awesome. Also, I almost forgot, but I wanted to give a chance to mention your website, the location where people can find your beers.
Yeah. So we're located in Greeley, Colorado. Our website, we do ship merch all over the country. We don't ship beer, but we do have distribution all over the country right now.
Oh, great.
Since we've been talking about barrel aged stout, we are releasing our second nationally released, I think it goes to 13 of our markets, our second barrel aged imperial stout that will see distribution. It's our 2023 Media Noche, and that will be released, I believe, right before GABF, which is in September. Mm-hmm. So I think you'll see national by October. You should see it all over the country. We're very excited to share this again. We did our first national release earlier this year and went really, really well, really well received. And we're really excited to bring another beer, barrel-aged stout, to people all over the country.
And I also want to give you a chance to mention your headline beers, because I know those are widely available. Yeah, Juicy Bits and some of the other
ones. Juicy Bits, yep. Juicy Bits is available in all of our markets that we're currently in. Unfortunately, I don't know all of them off the top of my head.
Yeah.
But yeah, Juicy Bits, Extra Extra Juicy Bits should always be available, rotating through stuff. Our seasonal, we do our quarterly beers. Coming up, we're going to have Peach Pie, and Trans Mountain Diversion is our double IPA. Peach Pie is a sour, and Trans Mountain is a double IPA, like I said, brewed with our good buddies Casey Brewing and Blending up in Glenwood Springs, Colorado. And we're excited to be able to bring those to people all over the country for a whole quarter of the year. Trans Mountain happens to be one of my favorite IPAs we do every year, so I'm glad that we get to get it out all over the place.
Awesome, Skip. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today. Really appreciate you being here.
Hey, thank you for having me. I enjoy talking about barrel-aged stout, so I'm glad you had me on to do it.
Awesome. Well, today my guest was Skip Schwartz. He's the head brewer at Weldworks Brewing. Thank you again, Skip.
Thank you.
A big thank you to Skip Schwartz for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also the American Homebrewers Association. The Homebrewers Association invites you to choose your own brew venture. Join for 1 year and select a free brewing book from more than 60 titles to match your fermentation goals. Visit homebrewersassociation.org/beersmith to join the Homebrewers Association and treat yourself to a new brewing book. And Beersmith Web, the online version of Beersmith brewing software. Beersmith Web for the web lets you design great beer recipes from any browser, including your tablet or phone. Edit recipes on the go with the same full suite of recipe building tools as our desktop version. Try Beersmith Web today by creating a free account at beersmithrecipes.com. And finally, a reminder to click those like and subscribe buttons on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever platform you're listening on. Clicking those buttons is a great way to support our show. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.